Today, we're talking about the climate crisis, but not with experts or politicians.
Well, there's the release of greenhouse gases.
We're talking to kids.
By burning, like, coal and fossil fuels. And
we'll be asking what they know about it.
So it warms the world, so global warming. And it changes the climate.
And how they feel about it.
Well, I feel really annoyed that it's happening. And I feel like we could have done something to prevent it. Now that it's started, we need to do more to prevent it.
And who do you feel annoyed with?
Everybody.
Because in the end, kids are possibly the most important people to be having these conversations with. And the thing is, no one quite knows how to do that. To talk to kids about this big, thorny, complex issue that is the climate crisis.
Oh, hey, hey.
Don't dig it.
Oh, no.
Leave it in the ground. It's time to get with it. Is that what it is?
I'm Laura Murphy Oates. And this is The Full Story.
Leave it in the ground.
This story started with a trip I took earlier this year.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison is facing hard-hitting questions at the Pacific Islands Forum in Tuvalu.
Tuvalu is a tiny country in the Pacific. It's about 3 hours north of Fiji. The population is just 11,000 people scattered across 9 different islands. It's sort of all of the clichés of the Pacific. It's beautiful white sands and lagoons and aqua water, palm trees.
Kate Lyons is Pacific editor for The Guardian, and she travelled to Tuvalu to cover the Pacific Islands Forum,
an annual meeting of the leaders of the Pacific.
Flying into a country at the forefront of climate change.
So we touched down in Funafuti, the capital of Tuvalu. And as world leaders arrive, they're greeted at the airport, every single one of them as they arrived over several days, by an incredible sight at the airport. It was really remarkable. We walk across the tarmac and there is this big installation set up. They've built this fake island that's in distress with sort of palm trees down and a hut that's been blown apart, the model of an island that had been ravaged by climate change. And around the model of the island is a moat filled with water. And as each leader arrives, children get into the water, up to their necks in water, and they sing to the leaders.
You're not planet, that is a problem.
And they sing this sort of plaintive song, save Tuvalu to save the world. We are on a planet, it has a problem, we need to fix it, we need to start right now. That song is, I think, forever lodged in my brain.
Why were these kids singing this song?
They were singing to send a message that their home, their island, their culture were all under threat from the climate crisis. Seeing these children in the water, seeing the kids throughout the week, raised a lot of questions. How much their voice should be heard, how adults should talk to kids about the climate crisis. So on the one hand, it felt like you wanted to protect the children from the knowledge of this sort of destruction. And on the other hand, like, no, it's absolutely right that these kids are participating in and having a voice in what's going on here, in making sure their voices are heard by the leaders as they arrive. And so I decided to go and talk to some of these kids and teachers and parents on the island to hear what they thought about all of this.
Tell me about the journey to go and meet these students and these teachers.
So the first people I met were two Tuvaluan teachers, and they're both in their 20s. One, Lutia, is a
secondary school teacher teaching geography and economics.
And Tiaseppa is a primary school teacher.
Yeah.
But you teach year 8? How old are those kids?
12, 15.
And we sat and chatted in the shade about what it's like for them to teach children who are living on an island that may not still be habitable by the time, you know, they are old.
What did they have to say about it?
Many of their children in Tuvalu, which is a poor country, have to walk to school and might walk an hour.
The temperatures, summer temperatures rising every now and then, so...
But that the heat that they walk in means...
They've been telling me that they've been experiencing migraines, headaches as they come right to the school, to the far end, because of summer temperatures.
At one point, Lutia said the kids might walk to school in the heat, arrive with a migraine, and then an enormous storm will arrive.
And then they can see water coming into the lens. Even the roads, they just walk on waters.
And they walk back on flooded roads. So there's this reality that they are living with and teaching in every day that they see the climate crisis.
But I had some students, they were like, if the natural hazard, like tsunami, coming.
One of the things they said is a constant source of fear for the kids, because Tuvalu is so low-lying that were a tsunami to hit, there is literally nowhere to go. There is no high ground to go to. Most of the island is 3 metres above sea level. Where do you go in that instance? But while the kids really fear these catastrophes, these cataclysms, you know, the tsunami, the big event that would wipe them out, the fact is that what they're experiencing now is a slow-moving disaster. They struggle to grow any crops because of the salinity in the water table. There is erosion going on that has meant that 2 of the 9 islands are becoming uninhabitable. Their houses are being destroyed. The rainwater is their only source of water now because they have no groundwater. It's things like the spread of disease because there's no fresh water to clean your hands or to have clean drinking water. It's things like right before we arrived, there was an outbreak of dengue fever that had killed a child. The fact is there are many, many impacts that will render Tuvalu impossible to live on. So I will also be making a radio show. If that's
you okay. Also got to speak to some of the kids on the island. What was that like?
Yeah, I chatted with a bunch of kids. The main two I spoke to were Velma and Patele. And we went to the local hotel. I bought them soft drinks.
Oh, hot.
I know, right?
Oh, here we go, some drinks. Another sweltering day and we sat and drank Fanta under a slow-moving fan.
Okay, my name is Velma O'Brien.
Velma is 18.
And I was born here in Tuvalu. What else do you want to know?
My name is Patele. I'm 18 years of age.
He arrived wearing his school uniform with his head boy badge pinned to his chest. He's a really lovely, very softly spoken young man.
And I grew up here in Tuvalu.
You were born here?
Yeah, I was born here.
They spoke so eloquently about the number of ways that climate change is impacting on them. But they also spoke of the real sadness for them that migration was already happening from Tuvalu as a result of climate change. There are 2 of the 9 islands have had such sea erosion that homes have disappeared. And they spoke that about friends of theirs who have had their homes sort of crumble because of coastal erosion and who have already moved away to Fiji or moved away to New Zealand.
The culture and traditions of my country will soon be gone. If we Tuvaluans could stay back and fight against climate change and make our voice heard, I think it can help us. So as for me, I don't think migration is the best solution.
You have faith?
I have faith that my country is not going to sink. And I just hope that it doesn't sink because I don't want to migrate.
And Patele said that he would stay unless the ocean went underwater and they had to swim to survive. And the two of them started joking about what that would look like and cracking each other up.
Because we don't want to live on the sea. <It's a>
Floating on the sea.
It just felt like a really beautiful but terrible and surreal moment.
What did they have to say about Australia, about our role in this situation?
Well, I was really struck by Velma, who, when I asked her how she felt about heavy emitting countries, Australia included.
It's like they don't care for their neighbours. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry.
To say this.
She got quite embarrassed, and she kept apologising to me as an Australian for being critical.
Okay, I did a little bit of research, and I found out that there's this coal mining back in Australia. But that is a major contribution to the climate change.
I reassured her that she should say whatever she wanted. And when she eventually did, she said, I'm just really mad.
Because those wealthy countries, the developed countries, they should help us, but instead they're creating more and more disaster to us.
This isn't a problem we've caused. You have so much more money in your country and you're not making the changes to renewable energy that we have made within our poverty.
We know that they're wealthy and we're poor because we're still developing. But when we try and we beg them to help us, they just, like, they've got this feeling that they have to develop their own nation.
It was really confronting as an Australian to be there and to know that the rest of the Pacific was aligned and really saw Australia as the, you know, the hole in the canoe, the leaky point for the whole region.
I just want to say this, that we must act now before it is too late for my small country. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you.
It was great to chat with you both.
Same. It was great chatting with you too.
Now, one last thing. I promise this is actually the last thing.
Can
I get a photo? Being in Tuvalu was incredibly affecting, really. Like it prompted a lot of questions about the responsibility to kids, about the impact that climate change is having on kids already, will have on kids. And it got me wondering about the best ways to talk to children globally about this issue. I saw these incredibly informed, incredibly passionate and incredibly frightened children in Tuvalu and wondered what the experience was like for Aussie kids who are maybe not experiencing the impacts of climate change as directly right now, but are still grappling with the same future for the world.
Next, Kate returns to Australia.
Is on the right.
Yes, thank you, Google. So I decided to reach out to this family, Byron and Jess Smith, and their kids,
ooh, park,
who I know to be really thoughtful parents. Cool. Byron's an ecological ethicist and has done a lot of thinking about climate change and especially our emotional reactions to climate change. And I knew that they'd done a lot of thinking about how to parent in a warming world and what that should look like. One of his jobs is to be the minister of an Anglican church. So we rocked up to this little house on the grounds of a church in Sydney. We visited them in the late afternoon, just a bit before dinner time.
G'day. Hello. Come on in.
Hello.
Good to see you.
Hi.
How are you?
Just clearing up from afternoon tea.
We met Byron and Jess's two kids, and they've asked us not to use their names, so we'll be calling them Emily and Tom.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Emily is 9 and Tom is 6.
Hi.
And the kids were really fun, and they wanted to show us around, give us a tour of the house, take us to their beehive.
Probably about 50,000 of them in there at the moment.
These are fascinating also because I can tell where good food is just using their bottoms.
They wiggle their bottoms.
They communicate with a dance, don't they?
Waggle
they waggle their bottom.
Yeah, that's great.
They're really fun. So we've got another beehive just over here.
Were you there for some of these conversations about climate change between the parents and the kids?
So after they took us to the beehive, we came back inside and sat down for dinner.
Shall we say grace?
We shall.
Thank you for the bees and pollinators.
Thank you for the algae that cleans the air.
Thank you for animals. Amen.
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 Bon appetit.
Over dinner, there was quite a lot of discussion about climate change and environmental issues.
What are things like at the poles?
Well, really cold.
What's there lots of?
Ice, and that's melting, and so the water level is rising as that melts.
I was surprised how much Emily, who's 9, knew about and understood about what caused climate change. It would rival, you know, many adults' interpretation.
the idea of the climate crisis is a pretty broad thing, and I imagine pretty hard for young kids to grasp.
Absolutely.
How did they break that down for them?
Byron and Jess are both quite careful to sort of only give the information in age-appropriate ways. And so often that's being led by the questions that are being brought up by the kids, and answering those sort of honestly, but also gauging where the kids are up to with their understanding.
What's an example of that?
Well, there was one moment in the evening when we were talking about like habitat loss and extinction.
Well, I was reading today about another creature.
And Byron told a story about the Bramble K. malomus.
The Bramble K. malomus. And it was a little rat that lived on one island in the Torres Strait.
A rat.
A pretty rat, you know, an Australian marsupial rat. Yep. They're lovely. That is now extinct. And it's extinct because of the climate crisis, an extinction that could have been prevented had action been taken earlier.
When we realised it was in danger, if the government had funded the efforts better to look after endangered species, then maybe a captive breeding program could have helped it.
And Emily's face as he told this story was stricken.
And it died out.
Her jaw dropped. Her eyes were bulging out. She genuinely looked really sad, really deeply saddened by this story.
And it's the first mammal species whose extinction can be exclusively attributed to climate change.
To rising seas.
Mm.
So sad.
Yeah.
Afterwards, Byron said to us, I probably shouldn't have told that story. You know, he'd been thinking about it and feeling it that day and spoke to the kids about it. And he said, on reflection, that was probably too much because there's no element of hope for the kids and there's just this sort of tragic inevitability about it. So I think for him and Jess, they're working it out as they go along.
There's a line that they're always walking and they're trying to steer it towards hope.
Trying to steer it towards hope, exactly, without hiding from the reality, which is very serious. And that's the other thing that Byron says is a really damaging thing that can be done, is just to ignore it, to stick your head in the sand and not talk to children about it, not to engage with it yourself because you find it too much.
So did you get a chance to talk to Byron one-on-one?
Yeah, well, I guess my approach has been to try to foster curiosity and in particular foster delight and wonder in the world that is bigger than just humans and bigger than our creations and devices, and then kind of let that curiosity lead them into, well, wherever it goes. And then, yeah, I try to answer their questions as honestly as I can in a way that I think they will understand.
What about when there is no easy answer, though? Like with the Bramble K. malomus, Emily was pretty upset by that.
Byron feels that it's really important to teach the kids that those feelings, even that grief, is really
healthy and normal, that the feelings of anxiety or dread, of guilt or fear or anger, that these are all good responses in the sense that when something that is good and that we love is threatened, it's right that we feel some of these things. And in fact, if we didn't feel these things, that might signal some kind of disconnect with reality or disconnect with our emotions. But having raised those emotions, people also need a way of processing, of dealing with them, of finding outlets for them that can lead into positive actions. Yeah, so I guess we try to model owning our emotions and processing them openly. I'm sure we're not a perfect example of that, but that's, I guess, something we're trying to do.
So this dinner was not long after you got back from Tuvalu. Did your trip come up at all? Did they know anything about the Pacific?
Have you ever heard of the Pacific?
Yeah.
Yes,
which I found quite surprising because many adults I spoke to had never heard of Tuvalu. Yes.
It's a really, really big part of the ocean.
That's right.
Yeah, nice one.
She had watched an episode of a kids' news show at school that had a little segment on the Pacific Islands Forum and remembered quite a bit of it.
Tuvalu's leader is, like, so he's asking Australia to stop, like, having coal mines and burning coal. Scott Morrison was saying, yeah, I'll give you money to repay for the damage, but that's not what's going to help. You need to actually stop doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. I was shocked and happily surprised.
How did that conversation play out when you guys were talking about it?
Well, Byron then asked the kids,
why do you think the Australian government doesn't stop? You got any thoughts on that? Why do they keep saying yes to coal mines?
And Emily said she thought it was...
maybe because it's making them lots of money.
And then Tom gave this really beautiful, insightful answer, saying that...
maybe because there's like heaps of land that they think there's nothing there.
They probably thought that the land was empty and not doing anything.
But actually it's special.
And didn't realise that it was actually really important, both to Indigenous people who might have a claim on it and also to the animals that might be living there. It was really touching.
And this sentence is from...
a six-year-old boy.
Wow.
That's cool. All right. Farewell.
What a... yeah.
Very smart kids.
Very smart kids.
Obviously, this whole topic is so anxiety-inducing. Does meeting those kids make you feel better or worse about this situation?
Both. meeting the kids in Tuvalu, my whole experience of being in Tuvalu made me deeply, deeply sad about what is happening with the climate crisis. It's a beautiful country. The culture there was so rich and so beautifully on display, so welcoming and generous to the visitors who came. If Tuvalu becomes uninhabitable in my lifetime, which some scientists predict it will, I will, like, mourn that, though I only spent a week there. And I'll mourn that for the kids that I met as well. But they were amazing kids, as were Emily and Tom in Sydney. They're brave and they're sort of seeing with clear eyes and they're unafraid and afraid of what will happen, but unafraid to sort of speak and act.
So obviously there's a lot of discussion about the role of kids in the climate crisis, and people think that they shouldn't be involved, that they should be shielded from this. After meeting kids in Tuvalu and in Australia and talking to them about this, what do you think about that idea?
I think that's quite a privileged stance to take. For the kids in Tuvalu, they don't have an option about whether they're going to think about or care about or act on the climate crisis because they're living it. And so, yeah, to suggest that Tuvaluan kids in the Pacific in low-lying islands shouldn't be acting to fight against climate change, just
ridiculous.
It would be ridiculous. And they would just find that baffling. And for Aussie kids, I mean, we've already seen that they do care. They do want action. I mean, you don't need to look beyond the school strikes to see that there is this host of children who desperately want adults to take this as seriously as they are. And for Aussie kids, they may not be feeling the effects of the climate crisis in their own lives as directly as kids in Tuvalu are. And it might for them be something that's on the news or in their lessons or hypothetical or in another place. But they will feel the effects of the climate crisis, all the scientists tell us, within their own lifetimes if they're not already. And so the idea that we should have them not act to prevent a future that the experts tell us will come unless action is taken now, it's telling them to bury their heads in the sand. And it's clearly not something that the kids are willing to do. And they really seem baffled that any adults would.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe to the show. Just search for Full Story on whatever app you get your podcasts on. We would also love to hear what you think about it so far. So if you're on an app that has ratings and reviews, give it a go. Special thanks to Kate Lyons for her time. You can read her coverage of The Pacific at theguardian.com. This episode was produced by Joe Koning and executive produced by Miles Martignoni and Gabrielle Jackson. Catch you on Wednesday.